Do you think that the economic rebound was almost too good then? I mean, when you look upon this, does it seem like the market's been driving the city, or is the city still in control?
Well, I think the city has everything to do with a little bit of the market. Not everything we can control, but I do think that there's strong investor confidence in the city. That's something that everybody asks for, because that results in immediately very good jobs. I mean, this the whole reason why we have 3.6 unemployment. You have economic drivers, and construction, of course, is very hot. But everybody thinks it's tech workers. That's actually number three.
Small percentage.
The number one economic driver in the city is healthcare. Five brand new seismically safe hospitals being constructed all at the same time. A very strong Mission Bay with biotech and life sciences helping to move in a lot of people. And then our tourism is done very well. It's always done well, but it's number two in economic drives. And, you know, we hosted not only America's Cup during that time, three World Series. We have conventions. We have, of course, Dreamforce that just exceeded all their numbers. Mm-hmm. And that's been welcomed by the city because of our convention status.
But the side effect, of course, is that a lot of people are being priced out of the city at the same time. So, you know, is this something that the city should take responsibility for, do you think? And
well,
can it?
We have to do it in concert with the private sector, because also a lot of this is being driven by the private sector as well.
And do you mean like mandating certain affordable housing levels, or what else do you mean?
Absolutely. But part of it is, first of all, let's understand the pressures that we have with good success, economic success in the city. We have pressures on affordability. I agree with people, everybody, that, you know, paying $5,500 a month for one bedroom is impossible to do. It's
for a
not
lot of
there.
People paying $1,500 for an apartment is impossible to do. But it's hard to find anything that's less than the twos or threes.
And why? Because we simply don't have enough supply. And this is why I constantly say it's been a crisis decades in the making, because we did not care about building middle-class housing and affordable housing at all. We were somewhat crazily satisfied with the incredible slow pace that this building had. I mean, why would you want to then be satisfied with building a few hundred a year, where all predictions were that if we worked successfully together and getting good jobs, people would want to stay here and be close to their jobs? So why aren't we building what I have articulated, 30,000 housing units by 2020? That's my goal. That means 5,000 a year. That means 5 to 7 times more than what we've ever built in the history of this city. Yes, I'm aggressive in doing that, and I can't do it alone. I literally have to have market rate housing developers contribute, and they are, and we're figuring out even better ways to do that. I also have to have preservation of affordable housing. We can't afford to lose affordable housing units, rent-controlled units, at the same number we're trying to establish, creating them and building them. So we put in hefty money in our bond, but also in our budget, in our robust budget, trying to protect housing at the same time.
Would you be able to mandate for developers to build only affordable housing, or to build at higher levels? Jane Kim, for example, has asked to have a 33% affordable housing level, but you didn't agree with that.
I didn't agree with that because that's straitjacketing. So every development is different. And I agreed with her that a goal of 33% is accomplishable if you allow developers to work with us in a flexible way. Mm. And by that flexibility, I mean some sites are amenable to more density and more height, and we have to have some agreement in those zoned areas for the rest of the infrastructure to accommodate that density. Whereas some sites are too small and you wouldn't get much out of it and the cost would be prohibitive. So how do you do that? Have an overall goal, but allow that flexibility to contribute. And there'll be sites like the Giants, for example, 40%. They figured it out because we are giving them density bonuses and more land mass in their Lot A. And we worked with them on
this
the front
down
end.
Down south of AT&T Park.
Exactly. So I said that let's not straitjacket anyone, because all that means is that the investors don't have the flexibility in order to work with us to accomplish the same goal. And here's the interesting thing, Ben. The conversations that we had in driving these goals is now having a remarkable impression on office builders. So it's not just market rate housing developers we're impacting. We're impacting everybody that builds anything that they've got to contribute to either housing, affordable housing, or transportation. Those are the two critical infrastructures.
I don't exactly understand how those connect. Do you mean like they would be providing space for groups that couldn't afford it as much, like nonprofits, for example?
I mean, for example, when you're building an office downtown in Transbay Center, I said, well, where's the workforce going to live that you're building for? And we're starting to make that connection that as part of the mitigation of even office buildings, they've got to start recognizing that housing of the workforces that they want to fill those buildings, they're going to have to contribute to the housing cost. It shouldn't just be on the shoulders of those market rate developers. Everybody sees that connection, but how about office as well? And I think that's a great direction that the conversation is going. So everybody that's building anything has got to contribute to the affordability crisis.
That is Mayor Ed Lee. He is running for re-election in November. So you graduated from law school UC Berkeley in 1978. And you became managing attorney for the San Francisco Asian Law Caucus, and you were an advocate for affordable housing and the rights of immigrants and renters. So I'm wondering, what would the Ed Lee of 1985 think of the Ed Lee of 2015?
Well, first of all, I think there's a lot of space in between the Ed Lee of 78 and the Ed Lee 2015. Obviously, I scratched my head saying, how come our city didn't do more for public housing residents? Those were my clients back in the Asian Law Caucus days. I yelled and screamed. I sued the city. I rent struck the housing authority with the tenants because we didn't think the city was embracing the lives of low-income poverty housing residents. Well, now it's my responsibility. Guess what I'm doing? I'm never going to allow a housing authority that is isolated poverty for residents in the city. And I care about African-Americans are living in Bayview and Sunnydale. I don't want them growing up in isolated poverty. Guess what that yields? A lot of crime and intergenerational poverty. I don't want our Latino brothers and sisters growing up in the Mission to experience that. And again, because of their immigrant status, feel that they're isolated in poverty. I don't want the Ping Yun tenants that I represented. They've got to have a modern facility. Those buildings were built in the 50s. All of those were built in the 50s to accommodate a certain type of resident. They've never been touched. They've always been patched. There's a lot of holes, a lot of systems that don't work. And so I want them rebuilt, but I don't want them rebuilt in the buildings that were designed in the 50s. They should be rebuilt with the residents living there on the sites, but rebuilt in integrated housing and in a community of different types of housing for people to live in. And what I mean by that is, the examples we're doing in Alice Griffin today.
Yeah. I was just going to say
with the Hope SF project.
The work with Lennar Corporation.
Exactly. There, right? But, you know, Alice Griffin, they're literally building on site, but they're building a little area for the seniors to live in. They can move in there, and then we can demolish their badly designed buildings or old buildings and rebuild the entire community with the residents in the community. We don't want that redevelopment of the 60s that moved people out of the Fillmore and out of the southern part of the city.
That must have been what you were studying in school, actually, as you were getting ready for that career.
Exactly. And that's part of the promise of the Housing Trust Fund that I first passed. A lot of people didn't realize, and we passed the Housing Trust Fund in 2012, we were beginning to build a base for my agenda as mayor. And that was housing, affordable housing, affordable housing. Now I get to do it in the most pronounced way, with a bold way. 30,000 is not easy to accomplish. And I've got to have everybody on their high cylinder, their accelerators in order to do this.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think that Ed Lee from the late 70s, the 80s, would not understand about Mayor Ed Lee?
I would say that you've got an Ed Lee that's much more mature about the economics of the city and how the prosperity of this city can actually be transformed to benefit the people that are struggling. That's what I'm trying to do. I haven't left my principles. Every time I hear about an eviction, whether it's a single elderly or a whole building of people, it gets my skin, my hair up. at all. That's why a whole building that was threatened with an entire eviction by a property owner on Vallejo Street, Supervisor Julie Christian and I banded together. And instead of doing a rally in front, which we weren't sure, we called the owner. We said, "You sure you want to do this?" And we presented the eviction documents. "Are you sure you want to evict these people? Because if the Seating County is going to back up the residents, what do you think is going to happen in this building?" By golly, he eliminated all of those eviction notices. And we have learned that the city can do more in this area. That's why I funded eviction protection. I funded attorneys to represent tenants. We have funded training programs for residents to know their rights. I did this back when I was an attorney, but I didn't get the city support. Now we've got the city support to preserve and protect while we're trying to build and increase capacity.
But meanwhile, evictions are still going up. I mean, it's you hear it all over the place. Even as you came into KALW today, I mean, hear about potential evictions. And
right.
So
well,
can
well,
you be more
well,
aggressive?
Well, of course, but that? We're, oh yeah. I mean, I think you're also hearing about eviction prevention that's going on. I think there might be more evictions that are happening. There are attempts, there are notices, but we've got resources and we've got people on the ground that help residents, help them in multicultural ways.
Do you have enough staff there?
We're paying a lot. We have put a lot of money into multicultural agencies that speak Chinese and Spanish in particular, and they have tenants' rights. You see this on a daily basis, and they are, I think, very appreciative that they're not out there alone. And at the same time, by the way, we take opportunities not just to fight the landlord-tenant fights that might exist as a result of the economic changes. We are also buying down land. And I say, for example, every time we can buy a rent-controlled building and change the ownership into either a trust or to help the owner figure out what it is causing them to want to sell the building and slow that down, if not prevent it, or outright buy the building for the city.
That's a really,
and we've got the revenues to do that.
That's a really interesting solution. I'm wondering how much you can actually buy, because a lot of people think if you could take the power out of the hands of developers who are getting into these properties and you put it within the city's control and the city has good motives, then maybe that would be a huge difference maker.
Well, we moved very quickly as I walked down South Van Ness Avenue with Supervisor Campos one day about 3 months ago. We looked at all the different sites and we realized, God, if some of these sites came in our possession, we can do 100% affordability. And we nodded at each other. Within 2 weeks, we bought one of those sites as a city. It was going to go up as a market rate condominium project. And we now turn it into 72 units of 100% affordable housing. Bought it right. It was an old gas station. And somebody who was smart in their economics bought that gas station years ago. Now they're about to do their leveraging, and they realized a housing crisis, and we were able to convince them. We have two other sites in the Mission that right now I think is, if there was any center of tension going on, of course, it is the Mission. I want to demonstrate that there are other ways to tackle this, and we've got to think of many multiple ways. Buying down land. We just bought a 6-unit apartment on the same block that we walked on Folsom Street. And they were about to undergo a massive eviction by a property owner. And we say, wait a minute, this is all rent-controlled units. You've got artists in the unit. You've got people that are disabled. Owner, why don't we do something here? What do you need? And they say, I need to get rid of the property. I've got some economics that don't work for me. Well, it took us about 3 or 4 months. We purchased. It's in our control now. And the residents who came out to meet me on that walk are now residents of the city of San Francisco. They're staying there.
Do you know how much affordable? Do you know how much of the city you can purchase for and buy the city? Then
no, we can't do all of it, of course. But
nor maybe would want to possibly. I mean,
but I think we are doing enough, and there's obviously going to be more. We think we can do enough so that we can signal to the private sector. And this is where a conversation with the SF Realtors is important. We even asked them, hey, can you help us get rid of speculators? And they go, God, nobody ever asked us. Everybody blames us all to be speculators. I say, no. There's a difference in responsible property owners and in speculators. And we all, even the Realtors, agreed with me. They don't like speculators as well. That's what caused me to go up and get rid of the Ellis Act and change it. It's speculators that have no honor to want to do anything for anybody
because
but line
their
pockets.
Business.
Because it's their business.
And that
so
makes
the
it
more
unfair,
we can prevent it.
That makes it an unfair playing field between people who want to purchase a single family home, say, or a tenancy in common with somebody who's using it as a business and an investment. I mean, they don't actually have the same kind of capital to work with, and it makes it completely unfair.
And they're not helping your family stabilize or anything of that nature. And
how
so,
can you block speculators, though?
Well, that's what we attempted to do with changing the Ellis Act is, you know, long-time people who buy property, if they're willing to keep that property for 5 years, they're a pretty responsible property owner and a buyer. They're not speculating on somebody's back. That's all we wanted was just proof that you're going to own that place for 5 years. And there's some stability. There's a relationship between a property owner and a tenant. And you're not out there just to make people's lives worse. And that's what we just try to do. And I think the conversation was rational, was fair, was understandable. We didn't get the state change, so now we're trying to do it as much as we can locally.
That's Mayor Ed Lee. He is running for re-election in November. I'd like to go back to the November election in 2014 for a moment, when you were a big backer of raising the minimum wage in San Francisco to help workers. And you were at a celebration. You were at a celebration when that passed. And one of our reporters was there, too, and recorded you saying this.
These are hard jobs. You're serving other people. And there's a lot of attitudes out there when you're in restaurants and hotels. And you got to suck through it. I know that. I used to get sworn at. Even if I was back in the kitchen, I get sworn at. But you take it because you're just knowing that you got to survive. And all of us know if we came from other places, we had to do a lot of things to survive in the city to be successful. Immigrant families know that. Low-income families know that. So, particularly tonight, I want to share with you that I'm personally proud of the entire city of San Francisco.
What does that make you think about?
It makes me proud that the city of San Francisco joined business leaders of different sizes and community leaders and elected leaders to say we can up our minimum wage, we can help low wage earners who, and you know, I always get emotional about this because I grew up in a family of low wage earners, and I know the plight that they have. Today, being on a stage with someone from San Jose who was working two jobs and had diabetes and he can't survive with the rising costs, and he's not in the great city of San Francisco or the great city of Oakland where we have passed a minimum wage that people can do better to survive on. He's struggling in an area of the state that he can't afford. And listen to that makes me very emotional because everybody, I think, deserves a fair wage. That's why I am helping to lead the Fair Wage Act of 2016. And I'm glad to do it with the backing of union leaders, non-union leaders, small and big business leaders, as well as Mayor Libby Schaft and I. I think we learned through that process, almost two-thirds of minimum wage earners are women. They're trying to have their families survive. People generally work two jobs, if not more, to survive. You can't survive on $19,000 a year. That's the current state minimum wage. That's why our cities were aggressive, and we're not asking the state to be as aggressive as San Francisco or Oakland, but we are saying and suggesting that maybe by 2020, you can get to $15 an hour, and that will be respectable for people. And I see a lot of these folks, these are healthcare technicians, they're people working in restaurants, people that are janitors, they're all over the state, they're small and large businesses, and I think they deserve a fair wage when the state is beginning to show some very strong signs of prosperity, but also there's an affordability gap that's creeping up. Look at the cost of eggs that's just gone through the roof. Look at the price of bread and milk. People can't afford that and they're struggling. You can't survive on $19,000 a year.
That's San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee. He's running for re-election. So what is your vision then, if you get a second term in office, what is your vision for San Francisco?
My vision is I want this city's prosperity to continue, and I want that prosperity shared by more people. And I have a broad prosperity shared agenda. We begin by the things that people might on a daily basis take for granted, but if it wasn't affordable to them, they would be screaming off. You have a transportation system right now in Muni that's one of the best. It's obviously a center of a lot of criticism, but we want it to be the best. So now we have Muni that is free for low-income youth, free for seniors, low-income seniors and people with disabilities. And it's a great system. We need to have a transportation system that's world-class. So when we finish the Central Subway, the conversations are already starting. Let's work together to extend that to Fisherman's Wharf. Let's have more subway systems in the city that are not surface above, that we can get rid of a lot more congestion, because that's the great equalizer. When you can get around to your school, your after-school programs, to your jobs in a public way, and that Muni is still very affordable to all people, and that we have great philanthropists that will help, like Google did with helping us with youth programs, we can help people be more successful. So good transportation system keeps investing into. Education. Again, I'm a big supporter of our public education system. We've got to make sure it's world-class, and we're up there. We are the best urban school system in the state of California.
Though your teachers are not paid as much as people on the peninsula.
Yeah, well, we'll get there. We'll get there. And I know the teachers are building a foundation in which they'll be not only fairly compensated, but we want them to be part of a world-class system. And we're building towards that. I believe truly in the superintendent and the school board. We're heading that direction. Obviously, they have sensitive labor negotiations with everybody. But when you also have someone like Mark Benioff and Salesforce Foundation investing $6 million in middle grades of their own vision with me, that we can have kids growing up with the best STEM education possible, and to have that middle grades then lead the effort of all the technology companies encircling every school so that no teacher or principal ever reaches in their own pocket to buy pencils and papers, to be followed up by a Chamber of Commerce of San Francisco saying, I want to create a program that's similar. So they created Unite SF, which means they're embracing our City College as well as our SF State and all the other education programs to make sure that they're creating talent for the future and that these companies are not necessarily having only to recruit in China or in India. They can recruit right here locally. And we're beginning with our middle grades, our elementary schools. We've got a great conversation going, and this is why it's another equalizer. Private investment along with the city support. And by the way, our city has never given more money to the school district than ever before, and they know that. The school board knows that.
Well, and you have the largest budget you've ever dealt with the city.
And we have a $9 billion a year budget. It's $18 billion now because we never look at annual budgets, and we look at two-year budgets. And we're willing to share that with the school district. We're willing to cover them in case something happens at the state that they can't predict. We have what we call the rainy day fund.
Why do you want to add to the police force with some of that money?
Because everybody knows that a successful city is a safe city. No one's going to invest their dollars into a city that's not crime safe, that doesn't have safe neighborhoods for their investments, that people don't believe is safe for them to walk the streets. And I think we are behind on that. We're behind on our charter mandated goals of over 1,750. And we're just trying to get there with the next 2 years of adding 400 police officers, 200 firefighters, 50 paramedics, and about 32 911 callers. We need all of that to have a strong public safety system. In fact, there's a suggestion that that only meets a charter mandate that was a decade ago. And if the population is truly increasing, we may have to think beyond that. But we're also thinking about what kind of police force we're having. This is where I really get with Greg Sir. When we hosted some kids from Martin Luther King Day to watch the movie Selma, and we met afterwards, and the kids from the mission, who were mostly Black and Latino, they said, we asked them, what do you want out of a city for you to feel successful? And they said, well, we certainly are sensitive to the fact that Black Lives Matter, and we don't want to be harassed on the street. He says, well, what do you think will prevent that? They said, well, if the police officers were looking like us and kind of coming from our community, that would be good. Well, we resurrected something that hadn't been working for over 10 years, a police cadet program that draws kids from our high schools into a three-year program that preps them for the police academy. And it's filled two classes by this last August. And they're all kids from the mission, from the different parts of the city. And we're paying them. This is not a free internship. We're paying them to prep for the police academy. They can choose not to, but they're working alongside police officers to get to know them. And they're looking like our community. So that's a really great thing to happen.
I'd like to finish with one kind of maybe personal question a little bit. And that is, what are words that you live by, Mayor Lee?
Well, I think I live by, if I make a promise, I'm going to deliver on it. That's, I think, trust in people that have the privilege of occupying a great position like the mayor. If I say I'm going to do something, if I say I'm going to build 30,000 units and make sure that over 50% of them are affordable and middle income, I'm going to do it. I'm going to align everybody in government to be able to get it done. When I say I'm going to do my best to make sure that the prosperity of the city is shared by everybody and that we don't have to say that everything has to stop. We've got to make sure people's lives are embraced and that the cultural diversity of the city is important to me. I mean it, and I will reflect that. I think the budget is the most deep reflection of our city's values, and I've worked very hard in collaboration with the board to make sure that budget covers all the cuts, HIV and AIDS programs that we face, that every nonprofit that is important, services are funded, and we even talk about their capacities in the future. We're doing well enough that we can plan for their capacities. Every park, every playground that people enjoy should be safe and should be wonderful and world-class. Transportation, parks, education are part of that affordability agenda, just as we're building and preserving as much housing as we can.
That's a lot of words to live by.
Thank you. Well, I do enjoy getting things done. That's another phrase. I want people to know that I'm not here to look for the next office. I love this city. I told people when I'm running for mayor, I will demonstrate to you and everybody who it is that loves the city the most.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.